Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to CSIS into today's discussion, an insider's perspective on Afghanistan. We're very, very honored to have two very distinguished individuals to discuss this issue. My name is Rick Ozzie Nelson, and I'm the director of the Counterterrorism and Homeland Security Program here at CSIS, and have a modest role of moderating these two distinguished individuals. Just to give you a quick overview of how this is going to work today, I'm going to interview introduce Dr. Attash first. He'll give his remarks, and then I'll go ahead and introduce Roy Goodman, and he'll give his remarks, and then we'll go ahead and go to questions. Before we get started, though, I'd like to ask all of you to just check, make sure your cell phones and pagers and what are off, or at least in vibrate mode. And then when we ask questions, we're going to have individuals with microphones here. Please limit your questions to questions and not statements. I'll be a very hard moderator, so it's be the question and answer period as opposed to the statement and answer period. We'll have microphones. Please say who you are and what your affiliation is. That helps us understand, the dialogue of the context of the questions. So without further ado, I'll get right into this. Our first speaker today, and both these individuals have published books, is Dr. Nadir Attash. Dr. Attash was born in Kabul. He attended the American University in Beirut and then returned to Kabul, where he served in the Ministry of Education Science Center, where he was the head of the Chemistry and Research Department. So he was a scientist by trade. He then went to the United States and received a master's in science at Claremont and a PhD from Florida State, and then stayed in the United States and worked as an educator and a statistician, both for the state of South Carolina and with a company called Westat. From there, and this is what I found one of the most intriguing parts about his bio, he launched a chain of automotive lube shops. I'm trying to figure out how that fits into the whole thing, and he also started his own consulting firm, Parsa. Dr. Attash has been a well-known activist among the Afghan diaspora, supporting numerous organizations in the areas of sports and culture and education. In 1999, he founded the Nuristan Foundation, a nonprofit organization dedicated to rebuilding rural areas in Afghanistan. After the September 11th attacks, he returned to Afghanistan to help with the reconstruction efforts and to serve as a bridge between the United States and his birth country of Afghanistan. He established the Afghan-American Chamber of Commerce and established the office of Kabul. And then in 2005, after serving as a senior advisor to the Ministry of Finance in Afghanistan, he was asked by the Minister of Transportation to serve as an advisor in that capacity as well. And then, as with most overachievers, no good deed goes unpunished. He was then asked with the great honor of serving as the president of Ariana Airlines, and did that for a small but very influential period of time. In fact, he was responsible for attracting one of the largest private investments into Afghanistan in its history. And he returned to the United States since 2006, and then from there, the last 3 years, obviously, he's a well-known expert on Afghanistan and an educator, entrepreneur, and an activist, and has appeared in TV and media and numerous conferences. And he's here today to talk about his new book, Turbulence, the tumultuous journey of one man's quest for change in Afghanistan. So I'll go ahead and turn it over to you, Dr. Attash.
Because I may read yours.
You don't want to read that.
Good morning. It's great to be here with you this morning, and especially I'd like to thank the CSIS people and folks to hosting this conference and this event. And I like to be short on target. Usually I'm not on time in terms of timing, so if I go overboard, you can stop me. I'm here to discuss basically the book, but I just don't want to talk about the book because the book is one tool in my chest of tools to talk about Afghanistan and what we should do. So although the focus is the book Turbulence, but I'm going to be a little bit more broader in my presentation here with you, but certainly I'll welcome you to read the book, and then we can have a conversation about the book. Let me start, you know, by saying that the turbulence is a true story about Afghanistan, told from two perspectives. A boy, which basically myself, and an airline. And it's interesting how the paths of these two entities crisscross, and of course at that time I didn't know this, but and then eventually the paths overlap, and it gives rise to some interesting and intriguing stories. In the book, I try to portray what Afghanistan was in those days when I grew up. And so a sort of three distinct periods in Afghanistan are basically portrayed in the book. Let me see. The first period, which is the golden age for Afghanistan, and is from the 50s onwards till 78, is what I call the period of progress in Afghanistan. And in this period, there are many episodes in the book depicting how Afghanistan was achieving its goals, not only in terms of the country, but in terms of individuals. And I gave my example of my life story in those days, and for institutions and infrastructure, and as a whole, the country was moving in the right direction. Given the fact that those achievements and progress were made with meager and scarce resources, it's very, I think, critical to understand that how achievement can be made possible if you have the right leadership and the people are on the same line, in the same tune with the government, working together to achieve the goals of the nation. And given the brevity of time, I'm not going to elaborate too much on this, so move forward to the second period, which is a period of... by the way, we have some pictures from the book from each period. This is basically a picture, you know, of my childhood in the center when I was, I think, about 5 years old, with my mother in the background, and the family portrait in 1965. I just returned from the U.S. as an exchange student. I think I'm right in the back. And this is basically when we graduated from high school, with my friend, who is a medical doctor here in this country, Dr. Ahad, the one on your left. And this picture is with my father when I was leaving for my AUB scholarship. Basically, in 1972, I got a scholarship to go to Claremont. This is my wife. In those days, you know, that was the fashion. So. And that's in a conference in Singapore. I'm the first one there on the right, on science and technology in the area. And this is in 1982 when I was receiving my diploma. I had graduated in 80, but I didn't fill up the forms, so I got my PhD diploma in 82. And also for the airline, you can see the differences between 95 and 1960s. You know, you can see the people with beards, you know, shabby kind of things had changed in that era. Anyway, and then we go to this era of really the great era of devastation for Afghanistan, starting with the Soviet invasion, actually the communist takeover in 1978 till 2001, where all the devastation in Afghanistan occurred, starting with the Soviet invasion, where the jihad that ensued to purge, you know, get the Soviets out of Afghanistan. More than, of course, the estimates are estimates, about 1.5 million Afghans died in that struggle. More than 5 million Afghans had to leave the country. And we have close to 1 million Afghans who are disabled, maimed, and so forth as a result of that. So it was huge devastation in that era. And I don't think that any Afghan has escaped the negative effects of that era. For example, in my case, and I tell my story, I was in the U.S. just a few months before the coup to work on my PhD at Florida State. So I should have escaped that devastating effects. That wasn't the case. And how much of an effect it had on me personally, because my family, all my male members of my family were in prison. 4 of my brothers, my father was executed. And with a lot of other friends, and every day we heard of these devastations, and the whole country was going through a process that was very, very much negative. And of course, it didn't stop after the Soviets withdrew. It continued even worse in some cases, the civil wars of the 1990s, and then the Taliban takeover and all the atrocities that were committed by the jihadis and the Taliban on the Afghan people. For example, this picture, which is in this in the book, is my daughter, my third daughter, Samira, standing in front of our house, family house, which was a beautiful compound in those days when we were living, at least for us, it had orchards and other things, but you can see that so this is an example of that devastation. And this is a document that basically we found through back channels that show how the communists, when they were executing my father and some of our relatives, and that there's a document, and it's in the book. So now I just want to move fast so that we don't run short of time. Then in the book, I discuss this area of the era of turbulence for Afghanistan, which is after the fall of Taliban. And of course, in that period, Afghanistan started with high hopes. After Taliban's were defeated by the Afghan forces and the U.S. and NATO, hopes were set very high for reconstruction, democratization, and prosperity for Afghanistan. And great progress was made initially. From 2001 to 2005, I think we were on the right tracks, and we made a lot of progress. But somewhere, things changed. And that's why the turbulence, that we move up and, it's not a one-way movement, it's up and down movement in this era. And we have been on this deterioration course since 2005, and I think still we are in that process. I've not seen positive effects, even though the U.S. military has recently announced that we have seen some positive achievements, and I don't believe in that unless I see really on the criteria that are important for us, not just getting marja or, it's very easy to capture. The Soviets did this every day. They captured the places. But to sustain that, to hold that, and to make sure that the population is not turning against us, those are the real criteria for success. But the question is, why did we move from our initial success to basically this course that we are following now, the deterioration? This picture is something that I want to show because one of the reasons, I think, is that we don't listen to Afghans. Although I heard some good things from my friend, Mr. Gutman, who was in Afghanistan. He said that now the U.S. military has changed its ways recently and are listening to Afghans, but I have to see the results. So, in my mind, that thing is still in formation. But we need to listen to Afghans. If you are there to help Afghanistan, if that's the purpose, it makes sense to listen to Afghanistan and then set goals, aspirations, and based on an Afghan view, not something that we go based on our preconceived notions and say, okay, this is what we want to do in Afghanistan. And a lot of this, the reason that we are losing the people from 95% now to 68% based on the last December's poll is because that we have not listened to their aspirations, to their grievances, legitimate grievances. So this is an example. When I was in Afghanistan, the first thing I did, I went to the most remote areas like Nuristan, and we, where there are no roads, you have to walk, you cannot take no showers, no toilets, nothing. But those are the kind of conditions that you have to face in order to listen to the people. You just cannot be in the hotel, Serena or Continental, and say, okay, now I'm or the embassy. And you can see that this is what I did a lot. Even though I was not a government official, I was not sponsored by anybody, but just for my own sake, to make sure that I do is based on something that the people want, and to establish the rapport that is necessary to be with the people of Afghanistan. And you can see a different era that we have these discussions, these talks, and I spent a lot of my time listening to the people and talking with the people, and I learned from that. I learned a great deal from what needs to be done, and this is a model that we should use. Now, I think even now we don't have a national vision for Afghanistan, and I challenge anybody who says that we have to produce it. Like this, the President Obama's strategy, we have yet to see it. We know it's there, but only the military aspect we have seen. But the overall strategy, I don't think that anybody has seen. First, we have to have a national vision for Afghanistan. And in order to do that, we have to include the Afghans in the process. These are some of the challenges. I'm going to skip this. I think we are running. So I think I'll go to what needs to be done. As the national vision has to be developed through a consensus development process. It has to come from Afghans. It cannot be imposed on Afghans, because whatever is going to impose is going to not be sustainable. And in a few years, we have to change, and the people are going to abandon with that aspiration or whatever it is. We need to sever our relationship with these unsavory characters. If you are there to help the Afghan people, we need to forge good relationship, meaningful relationship with the Afghan people. Yes, we use these unsavory characters to get rid of Taliban and evil power, but if this means that the Afghan people are hostage to these unsavory characters for the rest of their lives, I don't think that we are going to succeed. So, because these people only commit atrocities, only commit bad things to the people just for their own benefit. And believe me, they don't even know what their benefit is. Because if they knew, in reality, they wouldn't do these things, because they have a very narrow perspective. They are brought up during the war era. All they knew is killing in those atrocities. And we need to require effective governance in Afghanistan. Without a credible partner, I don't think that we can succeed. And a lot of journalists, a lot of analysts are in agreement on that, but unfortunately, we were unable to deliver on this, and we are still unable to do this. From Afghan perspective, when the U.S. says that we cannot achieve this, then they say, well, if you are so helpless that you cannot form a government that is your puppet, then how can you come and tell me what to do, the Afghans? So you will lose our credibility for Afghanistan, because the Afghans think differently. So we have to show that we have the courage, the wisdom, and the guts to make sure that we take effective action on these. And with this kind of a government, I don't think that any action that we do is going to be successful. Because what we are trying to do now is, we have assumed that this government is there, that now we are trying to compensate for it, and it's not going to work. Because look what happened to Marja. We brought an administrator now that we know that he was, he stabbed his son when he was in Germany and he was in prison for 4 years. Can you imagine that we cannot find one good individual with a clean record to be? And this is a showcase. Believe me, you made this a showcase. And with a showcase, we select an individual like that. He may be a good person. I don't know, because some Afghans, because of their conflict in terms of their adjustment to the Western ways of living, I think they made some things that thinking that they were still in Afghanistan. But I think it's totally inappropriate to bring somebody like this after we have made it known to the world that now we bring the cleanest government and the best people, and then the administrator of Marja is somebody, and now we are trying to defend that. So I think that's bad governance. We need to really pay attention to the Afghan National Army and National Police. I think given the fact that we did not listen to the Afghans and we didn't know the context of Afghanistan, we came up with a military system that is totally inappropriate for Afghanistan. From one perspective, from social justice perspective, the people who are in the military are the poorest of the poor in Afghanistan. We ask them to stake their lives for a few people who are getting rich. So if my son, you know, is in the military because of, you know, $80 or $100 or $120 because they are making a living, because I have no other options, otherwise I will not be in the military. And I go and kill, you know, to be killed to keep these few people who are getting rich, that's not going to work. In Afghanistan, every Afghan is obligated to defend for the homeland. In this is the mentality, this is the context, the historical context in Afghanistan. I don't know who changed this all of a sudden that we have this kind of an army. So with this, if we listen to Afghans, I think we can come up with a system that are going to be workable. And I think we need to work in terms of the needs of reconstruction, and we have to do it effectively. We cannot do it with a system where 80-90% of our dollars are wasted. By estimate, which I have done, some people, the U.S. effectiveness in terms of its aid is between 10 to 15%. And with that kind of effectiveness, most of our dollars are wasted, meaning that the taxpayers, we have to pay for it, and it goes to not to the purposes that were intended for. And so there is a lot of waste, fraud. So we need to bring a monitoring system that is effective, and we know what total quality or quality improvement is now, so that over we have to make refinements to the system as we get the feedback. And those systems are available in this country. We know the technology. We know that the know-how is there, but we need to apply it in a meaningful way in Afghanistan. I just want to, how much time do we have?
About one more minute.
Okay. the story that I kind of tell in the book, it was based on my own experiences when I was running the National Airlines for Afghanistan. And I saw how corrupt the system was. I knew there was corruption. But when I got into the system and I saw how much of corruption there was at high levels, believe me, the things that were achievements were considered to be acts of treason, acts of crime from those people, because they didn't want the National Airline to succeed because of their self-interest. Because, and if you read the Washington Post article, I think you can. Some of that now is clear, you know, why they didn't want the National Airline to succeed. But, well, of course, I had made a decision to work in that manner, but I didn't know that the repercussions would be such huge. I thought they would say, okay, step aside, we don't want this kind of. But so in the book, I try to give realistic pictures of what happened in my own case, as an example. And with that kind of a system, I don't think that we can succeed. And the major motivation for the book was that so that I could tell this story. But then, of course, I didn't want to be completely negative. Because there are a lot of misconceptions about the decline of Afghanistan, and that's something that I want to allude to. For example, a lot of policymakers, they said there was no state ever as an Afghanistan, completely contradicting history. Afghanistan, a rich history of 5,000 years, where there is always a state. Of course, the name has changed over the years. And they say that, for example, that the government never ruled Afghanistan. This is totally wrong. And there are some episodes in the book that shows that this was wrong. For example, my father was a governor of Paktia province, and he was a military person, but there was complete rule in Paktia, where now we have problems like Khost, which is one fraction of Paktia province. And in those days, nobody was outside the realm of law in Afghanistan. And they said there was a culture of corruption. This is totally wrong. Afghanistan, there was no culture of corruption. Of course, in every government, there is some degree of corruption, but Afghanistan was a relatively clean government, and that's why those achievements were possible with meager resources. And so I hope that by reading the books, some of these misconceptions and myths about Afghanistan are also resolved. And since we are running short of time, I'm going to stop my presentation and will welcome any questions and comments that you have. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Tosh. Those are really appreciate those remarks. You know, personally, I always find the personal stories, you know, the most compelling and so intriguing and interesting. But along the same lines, it's also important that we have, you know, journalists and individuals that capture the story when people can't actually speak for themselves. And our next author and speaker, Roy Glittman, has a history of doing that. He's currently the foreign affairs journalist. He's been a foreign affairs journalist in Washington for over four decades. Currently, he's a foreign affairs editor for McClatchy, and he's a former senior fellow at the U.S. Institute for Peace. His reports on ethnic cleansing in Bosnia-Herzegovina won the Pulitzer Prize in International Reporting in 1993. It was also the recipient for that work for the George Polk Award and the Selden Ring Award for investigative reporting. In 2002, he was a co-winner of the Edgar Allan Poe Award for White House Correspondents Association, and in 2003, the National Headliner's First Prize for Magazines. Formerly with Reuters, Newsday, and Newsweek, he is the author of numerous books, including Banana Diplomacy, Witness to Genocide, and co-editor of Crimes of War, What the Public Should Know. Today, he's here to speak with us about his latest book, his latest work, How We Missed the Story, Osama bin Laden, the Taliban, and the Hijacking of Afghanistan. So, Roy.
It's an honor to be here today and to help celebrate Nadir's new book. And I really appreciate CSIS for organizing this. Turbulence, it's a terrific title. And it sums up so much about Afghanistan of the last 30 years. And I do agree that memoirs of this kind, which really tell a story, and expose it and put it right before you and give you the experience, are just invaluable for getting insights into what's going wrong and maybe how to put it right. I must say, Ariana Airlines needs you back, so please reconsider. In fact, the whole airline industry in Afghanistan really needs you. I wanted to deal with one aspect of the turbulence that is the topic of Nader's book, and that is the rule of law issue. And I wanted to deal with the issue at the very highest level of the violation of the rule of law. And just to say a couple of obvious things, but sometimes they're not always so obvious. Afghanistan is a country, by the way, in my own career, which has fascinated me from going back certainly to the Soviet invasion period. But it's a country that's been at war for 30 years. It's a place which has a lot of history occurred during those 30 years. And much of it was not recorded by us in the Western media. And even historians have, I think, given relatively short shrift to significant periods in Afghanistan's recent history, which is why I did the book about the 1990s, which I thought was the biggest vacuum in the history of Afghanistan from the Western perspective, and tried to reconstruct a series of those wars. But there have been five wars by my count. There's a lot of history that many people would like to forget. It's principally the crimes that occurred in those wars. For the victims of those crimes, for the survivors, though, forgetting it is not easy. What was done to people by definition of just having fallen into a group, be it to Hazara, be it to Pashtuns, be it to Tajiks, or to anybody, collective punishment rankles. The sore festers, and as we know from the former Yugoslavia, it carries on from generation to generation as oral history. The original crime is often magnified many times from its actual size, and especially if there's been no exhaustive investigation, no judicial process for resolving it, no agreement on what happened, who was responsible, who were the victims, who were the perpetrators. My contention is, from my study of the 1990s in particular, and really going up to this day, is that impunity on the atrocities of war is one of the bigger problems of Afghanistan today. And it's all the bigger because no one in power will acknowledge it. And there seems to be nobody outside, including the United States, who wants to force this into the realm of public discussion and actually resolve it. As I say, there are five wars. The first one is familiar to everybody who's seen Charlie Wilson's war, war against the Russian occupation from 1979 to 1989. The second was the war from 89 to 92 to unseat the proxy government left behind by the Russians. 1992 to 96, the civil war between the Mujahideen, who actually were installed, this is Ahmed Shah Massoud and Burhanuddin Rabbani, who were installed with support from the State Department, I should tell you, between them and the Pakistani-backed Mujahideen groups, including Hekmat Yar, who were supported by Pakistan's ISI intelligence network agency, and by extension by the CIA. So you had the State Department on the one side and the CIA basically backing the other. The war between 1996 and 2001 was between the Taliban, who tried to conquer the entire country but were never able actually to vanquish the remnants of the Mujahideen government of Massoud. And then finally you have the war from 2001 to this day between the Karzai government, or the government that the United States helped install, and the remnants of the Taliban regime. Five wars. It's really quite a record in modern history. The American attitude on the issue of the crimes that have occurred in these wars is really, to me, surprising. Throughout these wars, and in some cases the CIA was the major agency of the U.S. government involved, certainly in the 79 to 89 period, and at times it's been the State Department that's carried the lead, but the policy has been, on the whole, pretty empty, throughout this period, the U.S. attitude has been very consistent. We've shown no interest whatsoever in the crimes and atrocities, some of which bordered on genocide, certainly in the Taliban period. Little was written or said about what Soviets did to Afghans in the 1980s, and almost nothing was written about what Afghans did to captured Soviet soldiers. My book begins when the Russians pulled out in 1989, and when I think the modern era really began. And I tried to record every allegation of violations of the laws of armed conflict, and to find out what had happened about what the international community did about them, if anything. The very first of the major atrocities was in 1997, and this was when the Taliban tried to conquer the north of Afghanistan. It went to Mazar-e-Sharif. They set up, they created a kind of a new government. They imposed Sharia law. They acted like conquerors, but they stepped into a trap of their own making, and they fell into it. Thousands of their troops were captured by a local warlord. This was not General Dostum, who's pretty famous for, as a warlord who's committed all sorts of crimes. This was actually the guy who overthrew Dostum at the time, a man named Malik Pakhlavan. And the UN saw this as one of these things. When it happens, you've got to do something right away. You put the spotlight on it, you investigate it, you send out people, and you try to get everybody to agree to what's happened, and then you try to identify the culprits and what happens next. We're just discovering, and even in the case of Yugoslavia, not that much happens, but at least the facts are known. And in this case, the UN tried to do that very thing. The UN's investigator was the first person on the scene. He said that he could see that thousands of Taliban prisoners were lined up and mowed down with heavy caliber machine guns. But there was no investigation, no formal investigation. The U.S. government refused to put any money into a UN probe because we didn't want to do anything to help the Taliban. And maybe that was a motive at the time. 1998, the Taliban again went back to Mazar-e-Sharif. This time, they were determined to carry out a slaughter of the people who they blamed for the massacre the previous year, but actually who were not directly to blame. That's the Hazara. And so they basically went out, ordered from the very top the rounding up of Hazara, the execution in the streets, leaving the bodies for the dogs to get at. The whole thing was organized by the Taliban, and it was an atrocity. It was a massacre. At least 2,000 people were killed. Maybe the number was even higher. The Clinton administration remained completely silent. There was never an investigation. And I'd say to my regret as a journalist that journalists didn't do their job adequately, with a few exceptions, didn't cover it, didn't follow up, didn't really bring out the facts. In late 2000, and so that was in the period where the Taliban were the dominant force in Afghanistan. After 9/11, the United States sent in forces, and with the help of a resurgent force of General Dostum and the remnants of Ahmad Shah Massoud's forces, forced the Taliban out of power, and the Taliban rushed out of power in Afghanistan. Governments don't usually wait around to be defeated. They escape to live and to fight another day. And that's what the Taliban did, and that's what they're doing right now, as you know. And when the U.S. And Dostum's people captured thousands of Taliban around Kunduz, and then they transported them to a way station, and then General Dostum reloaded them into container trucks. He sent them in these container trucks to a place called Dasht-e-Leili. By coincidence, it's the same place where Dostum's former deputy had put Taliban corpses in 1997. They loaded these container trucks, took them to Dasht-e-Leili. People suffocated by the hundreds, maybe by the thousands. We've really never gotten the numbers. And then dumped them into mass graves. I was working on the story when I was at Newsweek. And we went to the U.S. government again and again and again, both here and in Afghanistan. There was no comment. There was no investigation. Sometime in the year 2008, and it might be a little bit earlier, it might be later, we don't know precisely, General Dostum ordered the removal of the graves. I was foreign editor at McClatchy, a job I now have, and we sent a reporter to Dasht-e-Leili. And he went around to the site of the graves, which had been photographed from satellites, and found that they were empty holes now. Scraps of clothing, human remains still scattered about. He went around to Dostum. Dostum was out of the country at that point, and he went around to Dostum's former deputies, all of whom said General Dostum ordered the exhumation of these graves. The U.S. military had no comment as we did the story. The U.S. embassy refused to talk to our reporter. The Afghan government, the Afghan military also had no comment. Now, what is the relevance of these crimes to today? I'm not just trying to give you, the sordid side of Afghan history, but it's because I'm convinced that it is very relevant. While I was in Kabul this past January, I went around and asked that question of people who either knew the Taliban perspective or had a sense of the Western perspective or just knew something about Afghan history. So here's one view. Vahid Mojdeh, some of you may know him. He's a former Taliban official. He's friendly to the Afghan government. He supports the Afghan constitution, but he has good lines out to the Taliban leadership. And this is what he said. That massacre, and he's referring to the 2001 massacre at Dasht-e-Leili, was the foundation for all the fighting that is now going on. And he said General Dostum did this work. I went then to the U.S. military, because I thought this was a fairly interesting summing up of relevance. And I asked, what do you think of the of this statement by Mr. Mojdeh? And to my amazement, American officials at the very heights of the military basically said they agreed. And let me give you a quote. I talked to this general, but it was on background, so I can't give you his name. The massacre, he said, has absolutely increased Taliban motivation. Those kinds of things just thicken the hatred and cause more people to join the Taliban. As for General Dostum, he said, when leaders like that, leaders, quote unquote, like that, do stupid things like that, they only serve to hurt what we're trying to do out here. So a footnote, General Dostum, far from, he had been in exile for a while because he had been beating up people and getting out of control. General Dostum has now been appointed chief of the Afghan army by Karzai. And sometime in January, without any public debate, and at a point that Parliament was not in session, President Karzai is reported to have issued yet another amnesty for Dostum and all the others against whom war crimes charges could be placed. I say is reported to have because nobody really knows for sure whether this amnesty has been issued and taken effect. Anyway, my conclusion is that the problem remains hidden, but it is a lethal one. And it's at the center of bringing stability to Afghanistan and preparing the way for an American exit. If the Afghans won't address it, and I think for various political reasons the Karzai government is not going to, the United States should. If the United States won't, well, then perhaps the International Criminal Court should. Someone should take this up. I'm not saying that this is going to end the turbulence of 30 years, but it could certainly help. Thank you.
Well, thank you both for those very, intriguing and compelling remarks. We'll go ahead and get right into questions. Again, we have microphones throughout the room. I'll go ahead and ask the first question, though, and it'll be to both the speakers here. You both touched on an issue, at least a theme that I picked up, of credibility and how important that is to success in Afghanistan. So I would like to know, there's issues regarding the credibility of the Karzai government. What needs to be done, what can be done about that, and who needs to be involved in that process? So Dr. Atash, we'll start with you, sir.
I think that we should have been proactive on that issue, making sure that the presidential elections were fair, open, and just for all people. We didn't do that. So we know that there was massive fraud, and as a result of that fraud, President Karzai got elected. So the issue is, what should we do now to enhance the credibility of a tainted president? I don't think that we can restore it completely, but at least we can enhance it to the extent that we have adequate credibility and legitimacy from the eyes of the Afghans. The first thing that we should do is demand from President Karzai and persuade him in a very friendly way that he should appoint a credible, competent, and dedicated people. The problem in Afghanistan now is that, and I've been challenged by some Afghans, show me one individual that is not in the payroll of a foreign government that is in the cabinet. So that's the kind of, whether this is truth or not, that's the perception in Afghanistan. And with that perception, do you think that the Afghans would follow that kind of a government? And the second thing is that we need to deliver on the services for the people very quickly. And I think the issue that Mr. Gutman raised is a very important issue. Somehow we have to hold these people that have committed crimes. And I'm not only talking about war crimes, about economic crimes, about massive things that have been done in this in these few years. I think we need to hold them accountable, and I think those things would at least restore some of this lost accountability, and I think at least to the extent that we have a workable government.
Thank you very much. Mr. Gutman?
I was very fascinated while I was there. I was very fascinated while I was there to see the parliament actually acting up and acting like a parliament and rejecting many of the nominations of President Karzai for his new government as a kind of a protest against his legitimacy. I think they made some errors. They knocked out some good people, but they also knocked out some people who never should have been on the list anyway. And they did it twice. And I went to one or two parliamentary debates, and I was really quite impressed by the openness of their discussion and their open criticism. I mean, for a parliament that had been really in the pocket of President Karzai all along, that these guys were really angry. They were, and I thought the basis of their anger was that the president himself's his own legitimacy was in question. And the one thing that, the one ray of hope maybe that you could have in a system of such that has not really worked there, is that the parliament could become could actually do its job as a as an equal branch of government. Now the problem is they're about to have elections. Karzai wanted to do it actually as early as May. And he was going to stack the deck once again and try to see that his people got elected everywhere. And the parliament resisted that, as did the international community. And that election now is slated, I think, for the end of this year. And once again, President Karzai is trying his very best to load the decks in his favor. This is something where the international community has a voice. It's also something where the Afghans have a voice, and where the parliament has a voice. This is a play in progress. I think the one thing you could hope for in this period while Karzai is president is for a parliament that actually does its job and starts to expose corruption and so on. One of the fascinating things to me is that representatives, even if they didn't get elected completely in the most honest way, and this goes out, actually I've been in Iraq as well, another nascent democratic system, is that they still have to represent their constituents, or their constituents expect them to represent them, and that when something goes very wrong, as it did in the national elections, constituents come to the members of parliament and complain, and if the complaints rise enough, there is that thing. And so, with all the flaws of the system that are there, and there are many that were created in the Bonn conference, that may be the one little glimmer of hope.
Great. Thank you both so much. Okay, we'll go to the audience for questions. Right here in the middle, the microphone. Again, please state your name and your affiliation and question.
Thank you. My name is Dr. Warner Anderson. I'm with the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Defense for Health Affairs, the International Health Division. My question primarily is to Dr. Attash. This is going to be a tough question, but you wanted the military to ask Afghans the questions, so here goes. I think we all believe that all development all projects in Afghanistan need to be sustainable. How do you achieve sustainability in a nation that has virtually no tax base and whose major product seems to be illegal in all countries, including Afghanistan?
I think here again, your question is premised on misconceptions and myths about Afghanistan. Just go back to 30 years ago in Afghanistan, prior to the, we had quite a many projects that were sustainable, and a lot of projects done only with Afghan resource. Think of, for example, the Kabul-Jalalabad road, this new road, the Mahipar. The engineers were Afghans, the workers were Afghans, and this was completely an Afghan project. No foreign assistance whatsoever committed to that. So the fact that those projects were sustainable, and even the projects that were done with the assistance from other countries, the major player, major conduit were Afghans, and the projects were designed by Afghans and with the support and help of USSR, Germany, and other countries. And those projects are still, some of them are working. Look at Surubi hydroelectric. This was one of the oldest projects in the hydroelectric in Afghanistan. It's still working. The Naglu, which is in the Mahipar, which is a German, Naglu was a Russian. All of these projects were sustainable, plus many more projects. I think that the way that we can make projects sustainable, first, those projects have to be relevant and needs to be fit with the national goals. And I have experience with small projects. That's why we went to those people. And I have projects in Nuristan, for example, through Nuristan Foundation now, that's still running. For example, small hydroelectric projects. The way we did the projects was we sat with the people and said, okay, what do you really need in this community? And then they would identify their needs. And then we say, okay, now what is your contribution to that? Because it's going to benefit your, you know, improve your life. And what do you really actually do not have that we can provide you? And through this cooperative ventures with the people, I think the projects were much more sustainable. Some of the projects, unfortunately, were done very quickly in those days, and through, especially through the National Solidarity Program. That was a good program, but I think some of those things were done because just to accomplish things in remote areas and in provinces. And I think we can do it, provided that we have a credible Afghan government, and there is no corruption, and that it fits the national vision and national plan.
Great, thank you. We'll go right here to the front in the red shirt.
Stanley Kober with the Cato Institute for Dr. Attash. You said we should demand of President Karzai that such and so. Let's say we demand it, and he tells us to go jump in a lake. So what's the threat? What do we have that is so intimidating that he would submit to our demand?
Let me answer that from an Afghan perspective. The Afghans say, who brought President Karzai into power? And who is keeping him in power? The fact that we cannot do anything about it, whether that's real or imaginary, from an Afghan perspective, that's something that's kind of baloney.
So you're saying we should have a coup?
Well, let me tell you. There are mechanisms in the law for this. And I have advocated those publicly, and I got into trouble on that. For example, what do you do when a president breaches the Constitution? By my count, and I'm not an attorney, 26 items of the Constitution were breached by this president. Some of them act of omission, some act of commission. So there is ample justification to proceed on impeachment if you want to do that. And it's not coup. Actually, it will be. But I think if you're serious enough, President Karzai will listen, and he will be the last person to resist that temptation. I think we should have a good exit strategy for him, and that is a very good exit strategy if he doesn't deliver and deliver on time. The problem is, I think, that some of the U.S. people are really cozy with him, and I don't know which. I'm not an expert on the U.S. thing, whether it's CIA or DIA or whatever it is, but some of those people are really working very close with him and are telling him that, yes, go stay on this course. Nobody's going to do anything with you. So first we have to get our act together and come up with a strategy that we really mean business. And I think if we cannot deliver on that strategy, then on that point, we shouldn't send more troops. We shouldn't increase the resources, because when you all waste it, and we are going to, my kind of worst scenario case is that the U.S. is going to kill 1 million Afghans in the next year and a half, if this situation is not changed. And what is going to happen is we are going to spend billions of dollars, probably $200 billion in the process in a couple of years, and achieve nothing. I think the best thing would be, then if that's the case, we should pull out. That's a much better strategy than continuing on this course where we are going to kill innocent Afghans and achieve nothing.
We'll go to Mr. Goodman. Do you want to respond to that?
Well, he is our guy. We created him. We put him in there. And the whole process of doing these things usually comes a cropper. I mean, not Afghanistan is only the latest example of that. You do want the Afghan people to have their voice, and obviously, what happened at the Bonn conference was a quick fix that just left the country some years down the road in a very messy political situation. I have to disagree with Dr. Attash on the remedy. I think Afghanistan is more than Karzai. I think the stability of Afghanistan is a fundamentally important thing for American security and for the security of South Asia and the security of the Middle East. I think if the government, creaky though it is defeated, if the Taliban come back into power, you are going to have a situation where Afghanistan becomes a magnet, as it was during the latter 1990s, for jihadis from all around the Islamic world. But it's going to be even more intense, because this will be to a Taliban government that can claim to have defeated the United States, the West, everybody. So I think we have to bear that in mind as the United States deals with Karzai. It's very interesting. I'm not quite sure myself which American institution or body or agency is dealing with Karzai very positively. I couldn't find one while I was there. Certainly at the State Department, they're all in disagreement with him. The U.S. ambassador is often at swords points with him. The General McChrystal is by default almost the person who sees him the most and who seems to get along the most decently with him, but doesn't have an easy time at all. You have to find workarounds. I think you have to keep an eye on the big picture here, and withdrawal in any short-term way and leaving the country to collapse, I think, would be an utter disaster.
Let me I don't think that I meant that we should withdraw. Well, my point is, I agree that this is a critical place and we need to succeed. And for order to succeed, we need a credible Afghan government. And my thesis is that without that, we are not going to succeed. So we have to make sure that we get it right on that issue. And I don't see any problem why we cannot achieve that, because I see it as a very simple process, and I don't see it as very complicated, given the persuasions that we have. And I gave one example. I think we can achieve that end. And so, yes, we should be persistent, be persuasive, and make sure that we achieve that.
Okay, let's go with one more question. We'd like to end on time. The gentleman right here on the right-hand side of the room in the gray suit.
Thank you. Frank Kenefick. I'm with Beacon Technology, a member of the Afghan Advocacy Group for quite some time. I was previously with the USAID, the State Department, and the World Bank for 40 years. My connection to Afghanistan goes back to the early 70s when we worked on the Helmand Valley program, the Kajiki Dam, engineering school of Kabul University, etc. I had a minor supporting role in the cross-border program, Charlie Wilson's war, and was called out of retirement early 2003 to lead the U.S. government program's flagship, the reconstruction of the Kabul-Kandahar Highway. We demined, reconstructed, fought with the Taliban, and laid down 250 miles of asphalt in 250 days, a world record, and much of that was because of Afghans helping us. Thank you. On the issue of sustainability, and I think Dr. Gutman's point about five wars in Afghanistan, I believe there's a sixth war, and some of us have sort of touched on that in this room. I am a known critic of my own government here because I've seen it, not as Dr. Attash says, with the courage and wisdom to do what's right and the guts to pursue that. I've seen infighting in the U.S. government go on now for 7 years. There was a very good start up through late 2005. But the infighting in the U.S. government, I can guarantee I worked in poppies in Thailand, Laos, Turkey, COCA in Latin America. I have a background in the things that people...
I'm sorry, sir, we're running short on time. Can you ask the question, please?
But my point is this. Until the U.S. public pressures its own government to get the plan right, General McChrystal and all my former good military colleagues and others are not going to be able to win. That isn't a war. When the Russians came in 79, there were 2 million landless Afghans out of 14 million. 80% of the infrastructure and economy was destroyed. When we returned, there were 10 million landless Afghans. And that's what they're looking for, and it ain't government. Thank you.
Sir, was there a question to that?
The question is, how do we get our government, Dr. Attash, to do what you're saying needs to be done?
Okay.
The U.S. government.
I think I see some positive developments, especially with the election of President Obama, that he opened up this issue in terms of why we are there and how we can achieve. And in terms of, I know there was a great deal of work to strategize for Afghanistan, but I think that's not enough because I believe that in the formulation and implementation and assessment of the strategy, Afghans need to be integral part of that. That's why we need credible Afghan government and all Afghans to be part of that strategy. I think in terms of the formulation and implementation, there is inadequate Afghan presence from that in that process. Secondly, we need to do more in terms of winning the hearts and minds of Afghans. And I don't think that it will be the PRTs would be adequate for that. PRTs serve their purposes when we had emergency kind of situation in Afghanistan. There was no government, and they. And there was corruption, basically. So we need to come up with mechanisms for delivering services and economic development so that Afghans see improvement in their lives. And I think there are ways that we can do this. How do we move the U.S. government? And, of course, this is a democracy, and what we are having here is an example of that. I think this is going to influence our thinking first, and we can develop consensus amongst ourselves, different circles. That's why I devote a lot of my time to meetings like this, and I believe that eventually it will have its effects. And I'm one that I really advocate, and you are part of the Afghanistan Advocacy Group. We work together on the involvement of the U.S. in Afghanistan, but I want it to be constructive and meaningful and fruitful for all of us. And I think we can achieve that if we work together.
Mr. Goodman, I'll give you the last word, if you have anything to add to that.
Well, I think that the U.S. for the longest time has treated Afghanistan as an object and has seen it as not as a real country but as a platform for attacking somebody else or defending something. And I think that the beginning of wisdom would be, well, we have to absolutely have to listen to Afghans, and this memoir is an example of an Afghan we should be listening to. But we have to treat the country as a real place. It's true they have no oil. It's true that they're but they have a lot of other resources, and their human resources are really incredible. Afghans, the character of Afghans is really, as you know yourself, really something to behold, and they can be some of the great people, and they can do great things. We have to look at it as a real place, and a place where we're going to be committed to help them until they get it straightened out.
Well, great. We thank you both for your remarks. I think we have copies of the books available for sale in the back, but we'd like to thank both of these speakers for those tremendous remarks. Thank you.